Hi, I'm Kyra Kellowan, an international educator who has worked in schools, edtech startups, and universities across four countries over the last 15 years. This is the Pilot Ed podcast, a series about how education is currently being rebooted. All of the educators I meet on this podcast are piloting something, whether through innovation in teaching, creating new trailblazing schools, assessing university applications, or recruiting students differently. Or maybe they're driving technological change in how learners and educators interact. This series comes at a time of unprecedented global change and rapid adaptation to new ways of teaching, learning, and engaging with one another is needed. In this second season, I want to specifically focus on meeting guests from the tertiary or higher education sector, as the need for innovation and new modes of learning in high schools during the pressures of COVID, combined with the changing behaviors and social demands of Generation Z students in a fast-moving external environment, has never been greater and will never have a greater impact on university intakes. Without further ado, then, welcome to Season 2, Episode 1, where we'll be meeting Mustafa Ez, who's Director of International Recruitment and Strategy at Huron at Western University in Ontario, Canada. I met Mustafa a little over a year ago at the CIS conference in Bilbao when Pilot Ed was a nascent idea. This is a conference that brings together high school career and university guidance counselors and admissions representatives from around 800 different institutions with a shared goal of supporting students making transitions from school to university, exchanging expertise and knowledge on the latest admissions processes, discussing global trends in international student recruitment, and of course colleges embracing the opportunity to promote their institutions are the norm. In Mustafa's session this year, he spoke passionately about access to international education for those without the means to attend those elite universities, and the need for this to be an institutional priority for other colleges like his own. I was really impressed by the financial support that Huron were offering to their successful high-achieving low-income students, and I wondered then how to help Mustafa in his important mission. So for this initial episode focusing on the college admissions side of post-secondary innovation, I wanted to ask Mustafa more about Huron University's mission and their commitment to access for students who did not fit usual international school pipelines. So, with no further ado, let's meet Mustafa.
So I really want to formally welcome you to Series 2 of the Piloted Podcast, Mustafa. I know that, you know, we met 1 year ago, almost to the week, at the Council of International Schools Conference in Bilbao, and hasn't the world changed since then? So yeah, how has the time that year been for you since we last met?
It's been quite a journey. And first of all, it's just really lovely to reconnect with you here. And a big thank you for having me on your podcast series.
Following
some of your other episodes very fondly, and it's a pleasure to be here. Yeah, the world's very different. A lot of our usual approaches to international education and enrollment have, of course, changed drastically. And of course, we have to acknowledge it's changed significantly worse for some compared to others. But I think, in terms of the topic of this conversation, our overall long-term goals and our obligation to access to students continues regardless. So we just have to find a way to make it work.
Yes, and that's exactly what the session that we met was about. I remember it was about access for students who were non-traditional, who came from non-traditional backgrounds, who were refugees. We were in the room with Mia of Amala, who of course was in Series 1. I was really just blown away by the level of support that some universities were showing, one of which is, of course, your institution, which you're going to tell us about in a moment. But I wonder if we can start with you, because I'm always interested in personal journeys. So what brought you to this work, and how did you kind of make it to be at Huron?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I moved to Canada at the age of 15, finished up my high school years there, enrolled at Huron. A bachelor's of political science focusing on international relations, took a very keen interest in world affairs, global issues. Huron is really known for that, and also focusing a lot on, issues that are important to global society and ways that students can make a difference. So being a part of that community helped me think about a lot of these different things. After I graduated, I had a very brief stint in consulting, but then I really did not enjoy it as much. And I came back to Huron, which I missed dearly, after a few short months, took up a position in international recruitment in about January 2017, have had the privilege of meeting students and families in really every corner of the world at this point on behalf of Huron. And today I oversee all the international enrollment at the university, and I work with a wonderful team of staff members from different parts of the world to help share the Huron message and identify students who are the right fit from an academic and character perspective for Huron.
Right. And before you moved to Canada, what was your life like?
Yeah, so we were expats in the Middle East, in the Gulf. Mm-hmm. My father had moved to Saudi Arabia in the late 80s to take up a position at a hospital. He was an anesthesiologist. And we spent most of our life living there. And, I attended an international school and had the privilege of meeting students from over 60 countries around the world and building those kind of global relationships. And as what tends to happen in that part of the world, your stay is never forever. You always have to move on at some point, is the life of an expat. So for us, we chose to settle in Canada. There are so many reasons I could talk about why we chose Canada, but we're very glad we made the move. And it's been a wonderful journey since then, settling here, working here, and a couple of years back, becoming a citizen of Canada and calling it my forever home.
Mm-hmm. And so obviously, your background then was in an international school. You would have mixed with students from lots of different socioeconomic backgrounds. And I know that now your work is you're particularly interested in access and in high achieving, low income students. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, how that's happened or what exposure you had that made you kind of turn your professional focus this way.
Of course. I mean, before I came to Canada, I guess I saw a society where there was a very severe division between the haves and have-nots. So basically, if you had the means, you could access world-class amenities, a great international education, live a very high quality of life. And then there was a colossal division between that and another side of society, which did not have any access to opportunities. So despite someone having all the goodwill and the intellect and desire to build a stable life for themselves or make an impact, they just simply were never given the chance. It wasn't until I moved to Canada that I began to see a society which bridges that. So not to say that there's no inequality in Canada by any means. Of course, there are serious issues of inequality here and access, which we need to address. But I think compared to over the 30 plus countries I've been in, I saw a society that was far more egalitarian. And it shaped my worldview in the sense that for the very first time, it doesn't matter what your family is doing, what level of income, two students who come from very different socioeconomic backgrounds can be in the same classroom together and have the same access to opportunities. And of course, share actively in the addressing and discussion of important global issues, because how can you have a classroom environment which is just solely from one ethnicity or one socioeconomic sector, that's not really a conducive discussion to addressing global issues or studying or conducting research. So seeing that in Canada has really shown me that it's possible to do, and that those of us who were fortunate to have this here have an obligation to as much as possible provide it for the rest.
Right. So was that a focus at Huron when you arrived at Huron as a student and something you found you were exposed to there? Or was it something that you grew, you wanted to implement? How has the reputation, I guess, of Huron been in that sense for being welcoming and open and accessible to all?
Of course. Yeah. So Huron is one of Canada's oldest institutions. We've been around since 1863. We've always had a focus on a liberal arts education that's very interdisciplinary, holistic, builds well-rounded skills, not just, being a degree factory for tens of thousands of students. So we have a small, intentionally small niche community, close-knit one. And historically, in the 1900s and whatnot, that wasn't obviously historically very diverse or from different socioeconomic backgrounds. However, our current president, Dr. Barry Craig, who came to Huron in 2016, he initiated this incredible vision called Leadership with Heart. So it's twofold. On one hand, it emphasizes character and contributing to society as much as academic intellect. And I don't think there's many other post-secondary institutions who value it as much as grades or exams or, reports and degrees. But on the other hand, from an enrollment perspective, it is absolutely a top institutional priority to have this academically elite education financially accessible as much as possible. And, for the size of our institution, there's been a lot of strides in that in the past few years under the leadership of President Dr. Barry Craig. And, he has personally contributed that from his own family to Huron and initiated several other scholarships and directed that for international recruitment in every region of the world in which we recruit fee-paying students who have the means to study, we also want to allocate seats and full funding for students who have the intellectual capability, have the good character, but they don't have access to the opportunity from a financial perspective whatsoever. So that's been really the main driving force. I just think I'm part of the team that supports that, but this initiative is far bigger than just one person and really came as a result of this very distinct vision that Dr. Barry Craig set.
I have a few questions. One is how are you kind of deciding where to go and which regions, you know, what is it like to be in one of your meetings where you say these are our institutional priorities and how do you make them? And then secondly, you know, the students that you meet, I'm very curious about the backgrounds, the scholastic backgrounds, the academic backgrounds that they have, and whether, you know, how you find them in a school that is, or in a system, which is not allowing them to maybe shine in the same way as a student who's come through a more traditional North American or international school route. So, it's a long question. Maybe we'll tackle the institutional priorities first. How do you decide where you're going to go?
That's the hardest part, right? I mean, so the willingness of the institution and the commitment to this vision is clear and frankly the easiest part. The second part is, you know, the implementation and you're right, finding the students who need the support the most. There's a couple of ways we've gone about this so far. So for example, we are a member of what's called WUSC, or the World University Services Canada. Mm-hmm. And through our WUSC membership, we have a WUSC local committee on campus that does have the funds and the organizational capability to sponsor a student refugee every single year who is, you know, coming to Huron through the works and effort of WUSC's humanitarian partners on the ground in certain countries. Mm-hmm. WUSC currently operates in many countries in East Africa and in the Middle East. And through WUSC, we've been able to support a student every single year. And what's remarkable is that about 3 years back, our own students, so with absolutely no prompt from the staff or leadership whatsoever, initiated a referendum to double their financial contribution to WUSC to support more students. And it passed with flying colors as a student vote. So, wow. You know, that's
so exactly... they physically paid more. They were happy to take an increase in their tuition.
They voted for that to contribute more to this fund. And I think, you know, that showed us the importance of this kind of philosophy of leadership with heart and why we emphasize it so much in our own recruitment, because these are exactly the kind of students we want to attract who want to make a difference in the world beyond themselves. And that's just one way. So the main other thing we've been doing as well is that a lot of our work in our office has been focusing on identifying, like you said, schools that are not the conventional, I guess, international school with the means and ability to study abroad. Mm-hmm. And honestly, you know, and I'll say this to everyone now, we are still learning how to do this. We've done this pretty well so far with certain schools. So we have had the privilege, for example, of going to countries, and when we're meeting with the Canadian ambassador or the high commissioner, we ask him or her, you know, yeah, we're here to take part in all the recruitment events, but we're also here to really identify students and schools who really need this kind of support. Can you point us in the right direction? And many times we've had our missions abroad or other community partners or even schools themselves or counselors themselves who know of schools that operate on this kind of more need-based model. Mm-hmm. They've been able to point us to these schools. We've actually went and visited the schools. We met with the school senior leadership, understood their needs, understood their students, and we've just made it happen. So we've done this with schools in India. We've done this with schools in East Asia. We're beginning to do this with schools in Africa as well. And so that's just the start of what we hope is a larger project to realize this vision of academically elite yet financially accessible.
How do you use the resources available to HE leaders? How do you make sure that you're understanding the decision-making process in the fullest, most global sense? How are you making those decisions? Because we know that talent is evenly distributed around the world, and yet opportunity is not. So the work you're doing is important. How are you zooming in on those factors in a student when you meet them?
100%. I mean, you know, across any school in different countries around the world, right? It's very, I think, dangerous for a standardized mindset, to have a standardized mindset when it comes to admissions, right? I mean, one school could have 25 extracurriculars a student can join, one school can have two or none. And so when you look at applicants and what they've been doing in their, as part of their overall profile, it's really not fair to say that this person who, you know, joined seven different student clubs or had the opportunity to take part in this kind of an excursion is any better than someone who really wanted to do that in their heart, but just simply did not have the means. That's, I guess, the crux of international admissions and something that we are absolutely very actively conscious about. Mm-hmm. The lucky thing for us is that we don't have a situation where We're an extremely large institution with bureaucracy and red tape. And so it's just very personal, honestly. I mean, all the schools that we've established a relationship with, either myself or senior leadership, the vice president or the president herself or himself, has actually visited in person. And we just sit across the table from these schools and say, we're just here to make the most impact. We're not going to, bother you with multiple forms or procedures or policies. And in fact, let many of these students bypass many of the application fees and all these other things that regular applicants will go through. Mm. We just want to make an impact. So we just say, we know you have brilliant students. We know these students don't have the means on their own. Let us know how we can help the most. And I know it sounds very maybe cliche and simplistic to describe it this way, but it's the honest truth. if there's not a way that works for them, we make a way that works for them. And it's just simply that kind of a personal relationship.
For a counselor like me, that's, music to my ears. That's incredible. You think, wow, okay, so my student, whatever their level of opportunity, if they are talented, if they're bright, if you can see them becoming a leader with heart, then you want them and you'll go out of your way to figure out how to attract them. But for another admissions director who has very, very slim margins or who has, their numbers they have to achieve, they must be questioning, how does this happen? How is this possible? You've explained it's written into the model, it's written into the ID, the DNA of the institution to be as broad in your selection as possible. But for the institutions whose bottom lines financially are different, what would make it worth their while, do you think, in terms of assessing students in this way or looking to diversify their student body? What's the benefit for them?
The reality of the matter is not any one of us individually can do everything or help everyone. It needs to be a collective effort. And, all of us will have different capacity and means to support students. That's just the reality of running any organization, and especially institutions of different sizes. I mean, that being said, I still think that on a macro level as a whole, the higher education community can do far more than it is currently doing. And I think models like we have seen with the World University Services Canada, where there are about, I believe, 80 member institutions, all actively part of this mission, I think that's one of the most terrific models I can think of, really, in terms of this expanding or other institutions elsewhere around the world doing something similar. Because, with that kind of a setup, it's a collaboration, right? So universities do what they do best, which is welcoming students, giving them an education, giving them access to opportunities, and partners through WISC or nonprofits will then do the rest of actually identifying the students who have the need and supporting them from getting them from wherever they are currently located in the world to access this higher education opportunity. Mm-hmm. So I think models like that are collaborative are very good. And at the same time, though, that takes a lot of effort to set up. That whole network, that process is a huge undertaking that probably took several years. So I think there are more nimble ways that really any institution can make an impact, even if it's a very small one. Okay. First, I think that you need to have buy-in from your senior leadership. I think that's very important, because only that way will funding be allocated, will resources be allocated to make this an institutional priority. The second thing, similar to that example about the student referendum, I think student population buy-in. The student union or student government or extracurricular clubs on campus or volunteer groups on campus need to be rallying behind this and supporting it from the student level as well, so that it's an institutional wide commitment. And then there are plenty of fantastic organizations or schools, whether it's AMALA or many others around the world, who have students who need opportunities. If every single one of us just gave one partnership to one school, and that's a direct thing that you can arrange. You don't need to go through a third party organization or a bureaucratic process. You can have a one-to-one conversation with that school and go from there. That's, I think, just the very first step that we should be taking.
We see education changing rapidly this year. And I'm wondering if with the pressure that liberal arts colleges, for example, in the US, we've read about lots of mergers, lots of closures recently. And your funding in Canada might be differently organized. So perhaps that is not as much of a threat initially or immediately as in some of those smaller liberal arts schools in the US. But how do you see current calls for change, just for institutions, small institutions, to be able to survive, being able to align with this vision? I guess what I'm getting at is, what is the benefit to an institution that's already scrimping and it's already having difficulty finding funds for its local students to go broader, to think in this global way?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is, there's on the one hand, there's a moral obligation to help students access higher ed opportunities, those who can't. But on the other hand as well, it's important for us to know, as an academic community, one that focuses on research, on discussing important global academic issues, you can't have an authentic and representative conversation that truly gets all the perspectives you need on a certain issue without that being reflected in your student body, in your faculty, and so on. So it's not even about, you know, hitting certain diversity numbers that someone would use as an advertisement. It's about really creating a classroom environment that fosters this. I mean, for us, every classroom at Huron is on average 33, and it's all conversation based. It's discussion based. You know, every time I had a class, for example, on international politics, it was important to have students from different countries, different socioeconomic backgrounds, different life stories in that room. Mm-hmm. So I think before we get into any of the other reasons and details, as academics overall, it's a prerequisite. It's a prerequisite to serious critical reflection on important questions, important issues, locally or globally. You have to have those different voices in the room. That's it. If you have just, a narrow reflection of society, you're not really making progress on or getting a true picture of what you're trying to study or do.
So you seem like a very values-led organization. It's something that your leadership must find important, that you have obviously experienced yourself as a student. What are the values that are incorporated within Leadership with Heart then? What are the values you want to see your students embody? Who are the educational leaders in turn then that then embody that on your campus? And tell us a bit more about their work.
Yeah, of course. So when it comes to our students, we make it very clear from our very first encounter with a prospective student or in a recruitment presentation that we're looking for these kinds of students specifically, students who will make an active difference in society, who aren't just there to build a life of personal success and then, you know, live in a closed off villa with their own cars and not have any interaction with the outside world. So generally the students who come, they agree and they relate with this vision. And so when they come, there's not much we have to do to kind of compel them or so say to be involved in these kind of initiatives. So for example, while we have a guaranteed paid internship program for all of our students, in return, we actually expect every single student to take up volunteer roles and to commit to a social issue. It doesn't matter what it is. It can be a weekend at an animal shelter in the city of London, Ontario, where we are. Mm-hmm. It can be a 4 to 6 month placement in an international local NGO where they'll work alongside the local NGO to support them with resources and skills, and which Huron will pay the full cost of. But the students do this with absolutely no certificate, no recognition, no bragging rights, no financial compensation. We'll cover the cost to make sure they're able to do it. But that's about it. It's all about truly developing a sense of empathy and a sense of understanding of important global issues. So the students all have to do this. Now, from the faculty side, from the leadership side as well, a lot of the research that's happening at the university is impact research, and it's looking again at critical issues. Mm-hmm. And that's how the faculty demonstrate that to students, allow them to collaborate with them jointly on research projects that would otherwise only be open to master students. So there's a lot of that going on as well. And then our alumni also are coming to campus, having guest talks about their careers, why they chose to commit their personal or financial success to important causes. We just had a series on our Instagram actually showing what our alumni have been doing during COVID. So whether it's executives at DoorDash, an app delivery service, allocating a certain amount of funds to address to food banks or people who need food, to the leadership of one of Canada's biggest hospital foundations, allocating extra funding to more mental health resources during the COVID-19 pandemic to address that also serious epidemic that's going on behind the scenes as well, aside from the actual spread of COVID-19. There are so many ways in which students, faculty, and alumni embody this. And we make sure those conversations are happening between all those different levels so that they are all understanding why this is really important and what kind of an impact it can actually make in the real world.
If you could wave a magic wand, let's say that you're in charge of university admissions worldwide for a day. What is your wish? What if you had the power to enact one thing to create lasting change in the system? And so you talked about the macro view, and it sounds like that's absolutely what the university is about. What would you like to see change in terms of the way that universities are selecting students?
Oh, this is a heavy question. The problem is there's too many wishes I'd like to make.
Okay, I'll let you have two if you really want.
Oh, wow. That's okay. That's more than I can ask for. I'm happy with that. Well, okay. So my, I guess one wish that's much more focused purely on the kind of technical admission side is that we move away from standardized testing. We move away from just numbers on a paper. And I really wish there was a way we can more holistically evaluate intellect, the promise and potential of students beyond just one examination, beyond just one standardized test. Let's find a way to build a more 360 degree picture of the students who are applying to university. That would be one wish. And the second wish goes back to one of the earlier questions you asked me around what basically inspires you or makes you so passionate about access to higher education. And I think back to my time before I moved to Canada at that international school, right, where you see a very explicit division of haves and have nots. And that bothered me. That really, really disturbed me as a kid. You couldn't justify why someone who's same, you know, same human like you and just happens to be born in a different jurisdiction or different area doesn't get the chances that you have. That's just not fair. And I couldn't stomach that as a kid. I mean, just seeing it growing up and accepting it just as the way it is. So, and we know that, you know, financial support doesn't grow on trees or whatnot, but I hope that we can, as a higher education community, just make this a priority. Yes, we all can't help every single person on our own. Yes, it's not reasonable to expect every single university to roll out massive scholarships for an endless amount of students. But I just don't think everyone's doing enough as a whole. I'm not pointing fingers to one place or saying that we are doing enough. You know, I'm just saying as an entire higher education collective, if we all made this a paramount institutional priority for all of us, I think there's more impact that we can make. And I think that there's more impact people that we can help than the amount that we currently do.
I'm hearing that you see education as a fundamental human right. I think, you know, most educators would agree. But you're also seeing, you're talking about change making, and you're talking about creating change makers, sending them out into the world, but also taking responsibility as a community for creating change on a global, on a macro scale. And I think this year, maybe that's become more possible in a way. You know, we've had to pare back the travel. You know, people aren't getting on planes, but the ability to find students who shine is still there, and perhaps even the ability to shine a light on more parts of the world through technology is possible. So I wonder if you can see any changes in the way that you'll be doing your work, say this time next year, or if COVID has had any benefit or any positive impact in that respect. I know that we know a lot about the negatives and we're living them right now, but if you were to think optimistically about maybe how to find those students, what would you do differently, or what's shaped differently next year?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, honestly, not one that in the midst of everything going on, we've had much time to reflect about what will happen after this is all over, quote unquote. But I think just from, you know, hearing your question and thinking about this right now, yeah, I think we're going to approach it more of an attitude where it's not necessarily, we don't need to reach the places that we can only physically go to. Every university team does not have the time to be everywhere all the time or the resources, quite frankly. So I think while the traditional approach will still continue in many areas and maybe for areas where more students are and are seeking that kind of one-to-one human connection with an admissions counselor from a university, I think we also now have become more comfortable as a whole with video technology, with having conversations online, for running entire events online, for having kind of interactive engagements between post-secondary institutions and high schools online. So it seems like the places before that may have often been overlooked in in-person travel or harder to reach areas will absolutely benefit from this. And I welcome this trend. Of course, we have to make sure that there are still a lot of areas which don't have access to sufficient internet resources or infrastructure to even partake in this virtual sphere that we've now established in the higher education community. Mm-hmm. So that maybe is also a smaller step we can start with, as opposed to kind of a massive, you know, opportunity of support. We can begin at least, first of all, by making sure that schools around the world, no matter where they are given support to access information, access counseling. Mm-hmm. You know, I raise my hat to the work of so many tremendous counselors I know who, aside from their full-time job at their school, take so much time and energy of their in their day to actually support these kind of students. I know that the Second Chance Initiative, for example, and others, they are heroes in my eyes for this kind of work that they do. So let's take what they're doing, make sure they have all the support that they need, and make sure that the students that they're trying to reach, no matter where they are able to at least join the conversation. If we can have an online infrastructure set up that's just auxiliary or supplemental to the traditional in-person approach, that would be a very positive development in the post-COVID-19 world, if you wish to call it.
Wow. I mean, it sounds like Huron is a really nice place to be a student.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I miss it. That's why I came back, I think.
Thank you for your time and for spending a moment with us. And I have to say, I think the students who make it onto your campus are lucky in many ways to have been, you know, plucked from wherever they've come, but also to encounter people who really believe in the passion and the power of education and what it can be used for as a force for good and a force for change making. So long may your work continue. And thank you for opening up the series for us. It's been a real pleasure.
Mustafa's perspective is one that has been informed by both his own international school experience and a firsthand understanding of inequality and deep injustice he witnessed growing up in the Gulf, and knowing more about his past and what it means for the non-traditional students recruited by his team now. We can ensure that in lesser seen or lesser visited parts of the world, innovation and adaptation in a post-COVID world can continue. Admissions conversations can and must remain global, despite flights being grounded, because talent is still evenly distributed, even if opportunity is not. We may have to imagine what college looks like again and again, and it starts in the short term. Leaders like Mustafa help to lay down the gauntlet for colleagues in international recruitment. Huron's website says that their liberal arts and ethics curriculum aims to give a personalized learning experience to students whilst also developing character, the result being students who are formidable leaders with heart, who care about the people and the world around them. With leaders like Mustafa at the helm, they're well on their way to fulfilling that mission. Join me for episode 2 in the series, where we'll be meeting Carolyn Barr from Leiden University in the Netherlands. We'll be talking to her about how a countrywide online admissions event set a new bar for meaningful engagement and showed us how collaborative efforts to innovate are often the best way forward. See you next time. You can stay up to date on Piloted by following us on Instagram and Facebook at The Piloted Podcast, or you can say hi on Twitter, just at The Piloted. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you.